Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined with my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And this episode is post-ADA Size Sessions recap. We had such a good meeting where we actually did six interviews at the ADA Size Sessions. And we were so busy interviewing, we didn't get a chance while we were there to recap all the exciting things. Plus, honestly, I'm still watching things on demand because there was so much amazing things going on. So in this episode, what we want to do is we're going to focus on clinical trials. I don't know. I thought this was like the best Size Sessions ever.
Size session that, yes, and it was so strange because I think that was, we're like, okay, are people coming? Are international people coming? Where are we with all of that? And I will tell you, I was told at the meeting that we had more international guests come and attend than ever before. It actually went up from the year before, which makes us feel good about, medicine in the United States and the data that and the quality of the meeting that the American Diabetes Association produces. I mean, there were times when there were three or four things that I wanted to go to all at the same time. That's how good this meeting
Totally.
is. And I can't wait for it next year. Like, plan on coming, you guys. If you've never been to an ADA meeting, if you've gone to other meetings, it's really, really good. There's all different kinds of science, everything from bench science to clinical practice and everything. We love it. This is my favorite meeting, one of my favorite meetings of the year.
And special kudos to you, Natalie, who was on the Size Sessions planning committee this past year. So it definitely was such a good meeting. And I think one of the things that's really special is that there were so many simultaneous publications during the
Yes.
clinical trial readouts. And that's always so exciting when you see on the screen, okay, now this is in New England Journal of Medicine or other journals. So it's very, very exciting. And so in this episode, we want to recap some of the big trials, and we're going to start with Vertex. So there's a running joke in the diabetes community, the cure is 5 years away. And people have been hearing this for 50 plus years. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of disappointment around that because, as we know, there's not a cure. But I think we are actually truly getting closer. And so in this study, this is called zimislecel. It's an allogeneic stem cell-derived islet cell therapy. And now this is a very small study. This was done in 12 people, and they all received this. And 10 of the participants were actually insulin independent. So independent, off of insulin, with 90% time in range. And so these results were simultaneously announced by Vertex and published in New England Journal of Medicine. And just a little bit of background. So this zimislecel requires immunosuppression. So that is one of, unfortunately, there was a previous therapy they were using that did not require that. But this does require immunosuppression. So certainly that is one of the limitations. But still really exciting to see that, these participants are completely independent from insulin.
So I think so too. And I think the big thing is we need to remember who qualified for this study, right? These were specific people that were developed, that were used, they were having severe hypoglycemic events. Severe meaning seizures, needing not just needing your spouse to roll over at night and get you a glass of juice, but severe hypoglycemic events, two or more within a year, and impaired hypoglycemic awareness. So we all treat people like this, right? That literally they could be 32 and they walk in the door like they don't know and they don't feel it. And that is part of the complications of diabetes, right? Your body gets used to those lows. Your nervous system doesn't react the same way. And it is very dangerous. So I am also really excited, but I want people to understand that that was the qualification for being in this study, was that they had to have severe hypoglycemic events, two or more within the last year, and they had to have hypoglycemic aware un they had to have impaired hypoglycemic awareness. I can tell you, I've had patients calling me, sending me messages through my chart. I want to get in this. I want it now. It's not ready for prime time, is it, Diana? There were only 12, the primary endpoint was met by all 12 participants, 12. So I think we have to take this with a grain of salt And yet we're all super excited about it at the same time.
We are, and there's an ongoing trial to evaluate safety, tolerability, and efficacy, and actually more participants and over 50 participants. That's supposed to be completed. I think it's supposed to be completed later this year. So that is very, I mean, it's very promising in terms of having some type of cure. And this isn't the only one. I mean, this data is incredible and it's been published, but there are others that are working on other types of stem cell therapies that perhaps won't require immunosuppression. So
And maybe we learn long term that it doesn't have to be as significant in immunosuppression. Can we reduce the doses of those medications? Can we, right? But let's remember, there were no severe hypoglycemic events. So these people are debilitated by hypoglycemia because they can't feel it, right? And they didn't have any, right? They all had an A1C of less than 7. They all, their time in range was, I mean, huge, 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 right? Upwards of 90% with all the participants, right? So the data, the outcome data is amazing, right? So 10 out of 12 participants were able to stop insulin altogether, up from 9 that was shared at EASD in 2024. So it's interesting too, because so that it was like, wait a minute, 9 didn't need insulin, but then two, more people are now coming off of insulin after this. So it's really interesting. I can't wait to see more.
yeah. And the other thing I want to say is it's 12 months of follow-up. So it's not like, oh, they were off of insulin for a month, right? Like this is like a 12-month follow-up. So still, we need obviously longer term data, but really, I just very exciting. And this was presented on Friday of the meeting. So it was just like such an amazing way to start off the meeting. All right, great. So next, let's switch gears a little bit and the Adjust T1D trial. Semaglutide in people with type 1 diabetes. Lots of interest in this. Natalie, you want to share a little bit of background on this study?
Absolutely. So Adjust, we're super excited about this. So we will use all of the GLP-1s for that matter, honestly, in people with type 1 when we can get the insurance to cover it, right? So let's just start there. A lot of us in clinical practice are already using it, but we need more published data. We really do. And ultimately, what do we need is FDA approval for people with type 1. So the Adjust T1D trial evaluated once weekly semaglutide at 1 milligram as an adjunct to insulin in adults with type 1 and obesity using AID compared to placebo. So everyone was on AID, and some of the people were given semaglutide 1 milligram weekly. A1C decreased by 0.7 from 7.8 to point at baseline to 7.1 in the semaglutide group, compared to 0.3% from 7.7 in the baseline for the placebo. At week 26, there was a 13 milligram per deciliter, so 13 points on your glucose monitor, right? Greater reduction in the semaglutide group than the placebo. So the overall glucose average came down. Time in range increased by 8.8%. What do we know about time in range? Every 5% change, increase in time in range reduces complications. We know this. So that was 2.1 hours per day from 56% at baseline to 67%. Largely due to a reduction in time above range, which makes sense. If you think about people with type 1 diabetes, those post-meal spikes, right, are hard because we got to give the insulin at the right time, the timing, what's the meal composition, what's going on with that. If we use a GLP-1 and we slow down that food digestion, that insulin has a chance to get in. And instead of having a big spike, we have a less of a spike where the glucose and the insulin meet sooner and that spike is reduced. So this makes sense. So time below range remains stable. So that's another thing. We didn't have more low glucoses, which is huge. In contrast, there was no significant time in range in the placebo group. So it stayed the same. So this was a 26-week placebo-controlled study with 72 adults. So bigger than the 12 people that were in the study before that we talked about, right? So now we're looking at more people in four different US clinics. So, and it was one-to-one randomization. So, and they were titrated up, right? We can't start at 1 milligram of any of the GLP-1s because of that increased risk of side effects. So they titrated them up or they got placebo. So AIDs that were used, right? We want to make sure that this is across the board. They used MiniMed, they used Control IQ, and they used Omnipod 5. So I love that they didn't use one pump. I love that there was a mixture of systems used, because it does help us say that it works with all of it.
As I'm thinking about this, this isn't even off label because all of the participants in the trial actually had BMIs over 30. So technically, like they had obesity, they should be able to access GLP-1 therapy to treat obesity. But as we know, cost and coverage often limits that. And people have hesitation about using it in type 1 diabetes since it's less familiar. And I think this trial is very important, being a randomized controlled trial, showcasing that we owe it to our patients with type 1 diabetes to offer this to them, because the outcomes, the weight loss and everything, the time in range, like you just mentioned, really, really impressive. The thing that I would be interested in is doing an RCT in people that don't have obesity. And because we know that there's also benefit, I mean, we see that there's benefit in people with type 1 diabetes that don't have obesity as well. So I'd love to see that kind of data too. But I think we can feel pretty assured from this data coming out that there's huge benefit in those with type 1 diabetes and obesity.
Yeah, and I think we need to remember the primary outcome was achieving time of range of greater than 70%, and time below range of less than 4, and a greater than or equal to 5% weight loss. So they were looking at both glucose control as well as weight loss. 36% of the participants met that goal. Zero in the placebo group did. Zero. So
Right, which is crazy. Yeah.
great, with a p value of less than 0.001, right?
Yeah.
So this is an amazing thing for those people that start with a BMI of greater than 30. I can tell you that I use GLP-1s in people with a BMI much less than 30. I look at it as for type 1s. Why? Because it's demonstrated a reduction in cardiovascular risk, those major adverse cardiac events, in people with type 2 diabetes, regardless of BMI. So I do, we try as hard as we can. We might use a lower dose because some people don't need weight loss for these medications. They just, so even a tiny bit. But this is a great place to start for us. We have to start looking at this. And they did this on purpose. They did this to look at all of it, to say these people are very insulin resistant, right? The total daily insulin dose and some of those secondary outcomes decreased by 22 units a day in people that got the semaglutide. That's significant, right? We see these people with type 1 who tend to gain weight, right? Because they have lows, they treat, they have highs, they treat. And it just is this kind of an awful situation over years. This is really going to help those people. There's less insulin, and there's less hypoglycemia. We've really made a huge difference in people's lives.
So, I mean, along with those secondary outcomes, the semaglutide group lost an average of 8 kilograms or 18 pounds or 10% of their body weight, which is really, really remarkable. And that translated to a BMI reduction of 3. So, I really, really incredible. And then also, I think there's a lot to be learned in terms of how to adjust the insulin doses around the GLP-1. And obviously, like they're using AID systems, so some of it is just going to be automatic. But I think in learning that, you know, more of the bolus dose was actually decreased compared to the background, that can help guide actually how we might change someone's carb ratio or correction factor, or if we would simply, if they have an algorithm that can be reset, if we would reset it with starting the GLP-1. I think these are all kind of some of the things that we're still learning, but trials like this can really help generate evidence. And there was actually a separate session at ADA where it was, I know it was Viral Shah and some others that where they talked about kind of how to adjust AID when adding GLP-1s or SGLT2 inhibitors.
Yep. I mean, this is an amazing trial. I'm super excited about it. And you know, again, what is this? First of all, this is really original. This was simultaneously published, and now we got to start working towards, again, continue to work towards rather coverage. So I think when Victoza first came out, right, when liraglutide, the once daily GLP-1, there was a study by Novo Nordisk in looking at, are we going to get this approved for people with type 1 diabetes? And they chose to stop and not do it. I think with once weeklies, and you know, as well as the fact that 60+% of people with type 1 diabetes carry a secondary diagnosis of overweight or obese, never mind the fact that everyone with type 1 has a higher risk of major adverse cardiac events. We need these medications and we need them approved. So trials need to be done and trials are expensive. We need to be patient. But I also believe that as many people as I can, I use them with them as often as I can. People love them. They really, really do. So here's to the next trial. Here's to a randomized control trial. And here's to coverage for people with type 1.
Yes. Awesome. All right. So let's do our next one, see if we have time for at least one more in this episode. So orforglipron, this is an oral GLP-1. And you might be thinking, don't we already have an oral GLP-1? And we do. We have Rybelsus, which is the oral semaglutide. But what is really unique about this molecule is that this is a synthetic non-peptide small molecule that activates the GLP-1 receptor. And so because it is a non-peptide-based molecule, it can actually be administered orally and there's no fasting, there's no restrictions on how much food or water. You don't have to worry about separating your other pills from it. So this really would be an easy, you know, an easy, easy thing to take. So anyway, this was studied in a phase 3 trial called the ACHIEVE-1 trial. And in this trial, orforglipron met the primary endpoint, which was a superior A1C reduction compared to placebo at week 40. And based on the doses used, the A1C reduction was anywhere from 1.3 to 1.6%. And the baseline was 8%. So it's not like they were starting off with super high A1Cs. And then in secondary endpoints, up to 76% of participants taking orforglipron achieved the A1C target of less than 7%. 66% actually achieved an A1C of less than 6.5, and then 26% achieved that A1C of less than 5.7%. And then in terms of weight loss, the highest dose, which was 36 milligrams, saw a mean weight loss of 8%, which was 16 pounds. So yeah, Natalie, curious your thoughts on this trial.
So we have people that just simply will never inject a GLP-1. Right. And we do have oral semaglutide, but it can be more difficult to take. Right. And that's you kind of hinting at that in your, well, you have to, and it is 30 minutes before any other food or drink, including my black coffee in the morning. So I could never do it. Right. I drink black coffee in my bed before I get out. Right. That's who I am, you know, so I could never take it. I'm not getting up. Right. So 4 ounces with no more than 4 ounces of water, and you have to wait 30 minutes. So there is a little bit of a nuance to it. Now, and so that's the challenge with it. Does it work? Yes. And actually, they're studying it at higher doses for weight loss because people don't always want to inject. This would make it easier where they could just swallow it with the rest of their pills in the morning. So I'm super excited about that. Why do they look at A1C less than 5.7? Because that's like we're saying, okay, are we putting someone back to, you know, not even pre-diabetes levels? That's what that is. 26% of people had an A1C of less than 5.7%. That's incredible to me. So I'm super excited about that. Weight loss wise, weight loss of 8% is not as high as some of the other medications that we see, the GLP-1 injectables, but sometimes weight loss isn't our only goal, is it? And sometimes I don't want so much weight loss for some of our patients. So I love this as we got the A1C down and still have an easy to take oral option. So, you know, the half-life is 29 to 49 hours, so we can do it once a day. We don't have to think about it. So I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, I agree. I think there was a lot of excitement at ADA around this. And I can't help but think of, there was a great debate that we'll probably talk about separately of like, which agent should you use, GLP-1 or GLP-GIP or SGLT2 inhibitor? And I would say like Alice Chang won it. She had SGLT2 inhibitor. But a lot of her argument was like, hello, it's oral. It's once a day. It is the easiest thing to take. And so I think like that is truly really important. And when you can have that kind of A1C reduction from a baseline of 8%, I mean, that is really, that's huge. That's exciting. So of course, there's more to come. We need to see cardiovascular outcome data because the molecule is a little bit different, all that kind of good stuff. But really, just really exciting.
Absolutely. And I agree, right? This is, so a lot of people are taking other pills with diabetes, right? They're, you know, ADA recommendations. They're on a statin, they're on a blood pressure pill, sometimes two blood pressure, three blood pressure pills, right? We have other medications. If you can just add one more pill to the pill box in the morning, that will make it much more easy to adhere, much more easy to and make it part of the day-to-day medications. I think this is going to be a great option.
Awesome. All right. Well, we just covered three of the really big clinical trials. There's so much more, so stay tuned for our next episode, part two of clinical trials. But for now, that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives.